Good morning. Every 4 years, Iowa gets the spotlight, and very soon it will shine again. Today, contributing editor Neil Milner explains the Iowa caucus. Days after the announcement that HCNS would end its sugar operations, Big Island farmer Richard Haas said his Hamakua Springs Country Farm would also close. Department of Agriculture Director Scott Enright looks at what comes next in the Hawaii Ag story later this hour. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vanderkoot. A Hawaii-born playwright who has fought her way back from meth addiction brings her story to Kumukuhua Theater with Not One But Two. And trumpeter Roy Hargrove performs jazz with a worldwide range of influences. He's on his first ever trip to Hawaii.
It's Wednesday, January 20th, the first day of the legislature. The conversation starts right after this news. A little Wednesday morning music as we say good morning on this first day of the legislature. Good morning, Chris Vanderkoek.
Good morning, Beth Ann. We should always have steel drums when Neil is on the show.
Well, it made the two of you very happy, and if only this were television
or we had a camera
in here. In any event, it's probably a good bet that you probably don't think a lot about Iowa. Well, until the Iowa caucuses come around. Every 4 years, presidential campaigns are often defined by what happens in Iowa. But despite media attention, how much do you understand the process? For years, contributing editor Neil Milner asked that question of his Manoa students, and he's received some interesting answers. So you have the right ones. Former Iowan Neil Milner joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Okay, so let's start with some basics here. What exactly is a caucus, and how does that fit into the overall history of presidential caucuses?
Well, a caucus means a gathering of people, and at its essence, that's what the caucus is. There are only about 11 states that still have presidential caucuses. Arguably, Iowa's the only important one. It's certainly the most important, the most visible one.
I mean, well, we have one, too.
But nobody cares. And with pretty good reason, because they're not going to come out here and campaign heavily for a few electoral votes. I think Romney came out here last time, but there isn't much that goes on. The way it actually works, this is based on the fact that I lived there for a while, and also if you read accounts, every precinct has a caucus. There's 1,700 precincts, and it all happens on one night, the Republicans and the Democrats on the same night. The parties really pay for it. The state creates a kind of legal framework for when it has to be. You meet, if you do the math, it seems like on average there's about 40 people in each of the caucuses. Sometimes the Democrats and Republicans meet in the same building, like a school or a restaurant, and you sit there and talk to each other about which candidates should get supported. Now, there's some math that's involved, and it gets complicated because the Republicans and the Democrats do it in different ways. But in essence, you're there for about an hour and a half. You talk, you come out with some kind of agreement that's tentative because there has to be two or three other conventions leading up to the state convention in both parties that ultimately affect it. But the important thing that gets the coverage is what happens in these meetings. And it's just basically face-to-face talk, people moving around the room. The Democrats require you to go stand in a certain place to show what candidate you support to start the thing off.
Okay, so I mean, that's sort of a basic primer about how it works. But why does this get so much press? I mean, people are asking that question a lot. Why Iowa? New York Times once called it a quaint process. Why Iowa?
Well, yeah, it may be a quaint process, but the New York Times has got plenty of people covering it. Why Iowa? The first reason is that it's first. It's the first primary. And by Iowa law, the Iowa statutes say you got to make it first. The other reason is that it fits into a kind of narrative, I think, a kind of a story about the way people would like to think politics works. This is a lot of retail politics, face-to-face. The candidates are there. Chris Dodd, when he ran for president, actually bought a house. And now, I thought of buying a house in Iowa, but I lived in Iowa. Chris Dodd lived in Connecticut. bought a house there. So you have this enormous amount of retail politics that the press likes to cover. It's also a sort of test for a lot of candidates. It's the first test. Now, it's not a definitive test by any means at all, especially Republican primaries. If you look at the last, since the 1980s, it's full of surprises. And more importantly, frequently the candidate who wins the Republican primary doesn't win the doesn't get the presidential nomination. But I think that's the main reason that it's covered so much. It just fits so well into a media narrative, and Iowa is easy to reach. Candidates can fly in and out of that place, can drive around it. It's full of small towns that you can get to that fit into this kind of notion of small town politics.
And people really sitting down and talking to each other about politics and having discussions that engage them and engage their communities.
Well, you know, the NPR narrative is that they'll send somebody into a coffee shop and talk to some guy who often is some farmer who's come into town to do something, and they'll use that as a kind of defining story of what I was like, which is probably wrong.
Okay, so the question that a lot of people ask is, you know, why caucus instead of primary?
Well,
Why go through all this complex stuff?
I mean, the dominant view is that primaries are fairer because they actually allow you to vote directly. Iowa has a caucus basically because Iowa has a caucus, because historically it always did. It stayed with the system for a long period of time. Nobody cared about the Iowa caucus. And then because of changes in the rules of the political parties and some timing issues that get kind of technical, it made it necessary for the Iowa primary in terms of the Iowa Democrats and Republicans to hold it first. So the question of why is it there, part of it is there now because it gives Iowa so much resonance. Whether or not it's necessary in a kind of, ethical sense or a kind of more moral sense, the dominant argument is that primaries are fairer. But there have been people who write about Iowa who say that's not necessarily the case. That this face-to-face politics, even though it's less representative, is still a kind of grassroots politics.
So as we are quickly approaching this year's Iowa caucus, February 1st is not that far away, what do you see as being, you know, maybe typical or different, or things that we might look for in this caucus that might have a potential in, you know, outcome difference that we might not have seen before?
Well, I think that let's look at two things. The difference in the Iowa thing in the Democratic side is not so much a difference. We've seen this before. We saw it with Hillary Clinton and Obama last time, where you have two candidates in a non-incumbent year, both strong candidates. The Republican thing may be different because the race is different. There simply are more possible candidates, but more importantly, there is an outlier that the party itself worries about very much, and that's Donald Trump. And so how this is going to play out might be different. Now, there are always, especially in Republican primaries, there's just always a ton of candidates, and frequently the one who wins the Iowa primary, like Mike Huckabee last time, got nowhere after that. But I think the thing to watch here is to see whether the organization or the sort of lack of conventional organization that Trump has, along with the fact that he's a very different kind of person, campaigns in a very different sort of way, and doesn't appeal to party as much as to a kind of broad amalgam of people who are not very ideological. That's going to be something to watch here, because you have to remember the primaries are either Republican or, you know, you have to declare yourself before you walk in the room whether you're a Republican.
With the caucus.
With the caucus, yeah. So I think the ferment here is going to be the same. Now, campaigs are pieces of jigsaw puzzles. And so I was not going to be definitive, but for the Republicans, it's certainly going to be a sort of different way of looking at things than usual.
All right, I'm coming to your house to find out what happens when February 1st hits and we're getting all that information coming back from the caucus.
I may be watching ESPN, but sure.
Neil Neil Milner, thank you very much.
Sure, Bethan.
Political analyst Neil Milner is the contributing editor of our biweekly segment, The Long View. He'll be back in 2 weeks. We'll talk to him then.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported HPR2. It's 8:14 and coming up, a harrowing journey through and out of the world of addiction. But first, your quiz.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we're thinking about one of the many influential Europeans who worked for the 19th century Hawaiian monarchy. This gentleman was born in 1798 in a little place in Scotland called Hazelbank. His globe-trotting life brought him to Honolulu in January 1844, where he stayed until the rest of his life. He began his diplomatic career as an acting British consul until he was appointed by King Kamehameha III to serve as Minister of Foreign Affairs, Secretary of War, and a member of the House of Nobles. He fell in love with the island of Kauai and bought a tract of land in 1853 that today is known as Princeville. He gave the parcel its name in 1860 after a visit from King Kamehameha IV, Queen Emma, and their young son, Crown Prince. His name is also the name of a street in Princeville, and it's his name that we're looking for this morning. We'll be back with it in about half an hour. You can call us at any time, 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you think you know the answer. And the first one to get it right, we'll get the t-shirt.
Hi, good morning. I'm Brady from Hale Aloha Homeschool. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR, Hawaii Public Radio. Join the conversation on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation.
Craving for addictive drugs can lead a person to destroy everything in her path, starting with herself. It's a feeling playwright Hannah E.E. Epstein knows all too well as a recovering meth addict. Her new play, Not One Batu, which is about to get its world premiere at Kumukahua, looks at what addiction has done to a young woman and the people around her. She's a former user who's now selling, spreading the evil that once had her in its grip, and Hannah is with us in our studio. Good morning, Hannah.
Good morning.
Having your central character be a dealer who no longer uses is significant to me. What was behind that choice?
I think it was the fact that being surrounded by it was really, it kind of battles the internal addiction mm-hmm. aspect, and it makes it a lot more difficult to stay sober. If you see it every day, if you are weighing it out, if you're touching it,
sure,
and then you're giving it to other people. And so it's definitely that thing of just like raising the stakes in a play and not making it easy for your characters mm-hmm. to really kind of get through what they're trying to get through.
And you have a character who is essentially victimizing the other characters, even though they're probably the people closest to her in their inclination, their lifestyle, yeah?
Right.
They're kind of her own people.
Yeah, yeah. And they're her friends and her family.
Yeah.
And part of the addiction is that cycle of who's using and who's around you and who are you surrounded by. And so by selling it, she's always surrounded by it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And she's perpetuating an evil, really. And I would think an evil that she's pretty well aware of.
Yeah, yeah. She's definitely the character. She's so aware that she's not doing the right thing, even though she, for her, she is doing the right thing. She needs to make money so she can feed her son. Mm-hmm. And in doing that, she's really like coming through in that cycle. She's showing each other. She's showing the world really that it's kind of a getting by situation for her.
Mm-hmm.
And she's got to make ends meet.
In the course of making those ends meet, there's an awful lot of moral compromising to be done.
Right.
An awful lot.
Yeah, yeah.
You saw some of that in your own life, yeah?
Right, yes, absolutely. And it's the lying, it's the scheming, it's all of that. And it just kind of makes a person go deeper into the drug. I think we were talking earlier about power.
Yeah.
And the idea that a lot of people who use meth, and especially this character, she's lost her power.
Mm-hmm.
She had lost her son, and she's trying to get him back through the court system. And so it's just like, if you don't have power and you use, you feel like you have it. It's that fake power that
right.
comes with the drug.
Right. Yeah. And it's as much a human need as the other, as hunger or sex.
Right, right.
And
yeah.
I sometimes think power is not as much understood as a motivator of human behavior as those other two.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. Because like you can lose your power through many different ways. Some people lose their job. She lost her son.
Mm-hmm.
People can be abused physically, mentally, sexually. And so like that loss of power
yeah.
is what people run to the drug for, is to kind of gain back that.
Because the effect of the drug is a rush of, well, what's it like?
Yes, it is a rush. It's kind of like going, when you reach that brink of the roller coaster and then you start just like flying down,
mm-hmm.
it's that feeling.
Exhilaration.
Yeah.
Excitement.
Yeah.
Fully alive. I've mm-hmm. heard that description many times.
Right. You feel things 10 times more than you feel them without the drug.
Yeah.
And so it's definitely an explosion of some sort.
One of the things I think that makes it popular, and I'm sort of making an educated guess here, among people who lack power, is that feeling that maybe nothing else is going to give you, that you're, you know, large and in charge, in control.
Yeah, yeah. And that's why I feel like it's the puffing of the chest and the red anger that you see in your body, and
yeah.
that the drug really brings that out in people.
Mm-hmm.
It's that negativity, it's that anger, and it just like bubbles to the surface.
And yet it's something that is probably fundamental in us, maybe going back to caveman days, right? The fight or flight, the aggression, you know, the need to survive in a harsh environment, which in civilization we don't have that, but it's still in us.
Yeah, yeah, it's innately in us as human beings, and I think people go to this particular drug to just feel things again, and usually the feeling comes out as anger.
And then when it becomes a fight for survival, like your central character, like
mm-hmm.
the characters in your play, you have to overlook the harm you're doing to other people, even people that you love.
Right.
But I think people who are outside of the world of addiction have difficulty understanding how you can throw everything aside for a drug.
Yeah, yeah. It's as easy as if you had a child and you would throw everything aside for that child.
Mm-hmm.
It's that ownership of each other, really.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And yet an addict can neglect a child.
Right.
That the need for the drug can yeah. overcome something as fundamental as the love of your own child.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It can really, this drug specifically, I think, over a lot of other addictive drugs in America or in the world right now, it really grabs a hold of you in a way that allows you to ignore everyone and everything around you, all of your passions, all of your family and friends. It allows you to lie to them and cheat and steal to just like grab on to that power, to grab on to that thing.
And yet it might be a moment of exhilaration that lasts, what, 20 minutes?
Right, yeah. Yeah, and then you're using again, and it's just a full thing. You just continue to do it.
Obviously, you hope for the play to be a a cautionary tale. The title is Not One, But Two. And that's really true. You can't even do this drug once.
Yeah, yeah. And that's a big thing with the Hawaii Meth Project, which I love about them, is their slogan is not even once.
Yeah.
So if once you use, a lot of people can just get addicted right away that first time, that first hit, or however you choose to use it.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's that addictive.
And the craving just takes root.
Yeah.
How'd you get rid of it?
It took a long time. It took many times of quitting. It took a lot of family and friends helping me out and, you know, showing me that my passion still existed so I can go surfing. And I, instead of using, I'll just go surfing
with
whoever. Life
can still be good.
Exactly, yeah. And art is so healing,
yeah,
in a way that I could write in my journal for 5 hours instead of using. And so that was really powerful for me. Writing and surfing were, and my family and friends, that's what saved me.
Well, Hana, you're living proof. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Really great to meet you. Hana E.E. Epstein is the author of Not One, But Two, which opens tomorrow and runs until February 21st at Kumukuhua Theater in downtown Honolulu.
The ambassador with the big to-do list.
We have a lot to do. As I think you heard in the State of the Union, we are only going to get more ambitious as the clock ticks and we head toward January of 2017.
UN Ambassador Samantha Power on Iran, Syrian refugees, and the power of small local actions in global affairs. That's next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after the conversation.
HPR selects and purchases programs from NPR, American Public Media, and many other content providers. Our station members have followed the money trail and realize that it starts and ends with them. Our thanks to these enlightened individuals, Carolyn Barkley of Charlottesville, Virginia, Barbara Marcus of Wheaton, Maryland, and Michelle Thomas of Anchorage, Alaska. We'd like to add your name to our membership rolls. To do that, call us at 955-8821 during business hours, or find out about sustaining your public radio station by going online to hawaiipublicradio.org. You're probably no stranger to headlines about lawsuits against the Catholic Church alleging sexual abuse of parishioners, but how about this one? The Roman Catholic Church in Hawaii is suing a local insurance company over allegations that the company won't pay out on long-held liability policies. Jared Blair from Civil Beat has the reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
So this is kind of a twist.
Yes, it is. That's exactly right. This is something that I came across, and it turns out that more than 60 students and parishioners over the last couple of decades claim that they have been sexually abused, either by priests or by brothers or other staff in the church, which, of course, has parishes and other programs across the state. But the company that the church has contracted with for its insurance policies, that's First Insurance Company of Hawaii, well, the church is alleging that they're not honoring those policy commitments. And here they've been settling a number of claims, at least 29 more are on the docket, to try and, you know, make up for this terrible situation. And yet the insurer will not pay out the money.
So what does First Insurance say?
They say they can't comment. They had not been served the lawsuit as of yesterday. They haven't filed a brief in this. I would imagine they will be responding in some fashion. But according to the church, they've had a relationship with First Insurance dating back to the 1950s. And this is really something that they feel that this is fundamental to what an insurance company is supposed to do. And yet they're using words like the insurance company has delayed, has obfuscated, has misled us as policyholders. They have actually said, they say in the lawsuit, that First Insurance is putting their own interest before that of the church as well as the sex abuse claimants.
So with First Insurance not saying anything about it, how are you assessing, or how should any of us assess what these allegations are saying?
With a grain of salt, of course, but I can tell you that the lawsuit is up on our website. You can read through it. The church is seeking a jury trial. They're seeking monetary damages. It's not clear how much that would amount to, but I can tell you that back in the 1950s, the insurance policies were for about $100,000 for each occurrence, and by the time it gets to the 1980s, those policies are for $1 million. The church is talking about actually having to liquidate its own assets and services to tens of thousands of people in the state if it, for some reason, has to pay out those claims on its own. It feels that the insurance company, that is their responsibility.
What's the total amount or the payout if all of those cases that have been settled were to actually see cash?
We don't know the actual dollar figure, but I think it's reasonable to expect that it would be in the millions of dollars based on the policy that is presented in the lawsuit by the church.
All right, Chad. This one I know you'll continue to follow, and we'll
yes,
talk
we
about
will.
It when we get more to talk about. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Bethann.
Chad Blair reports for Civil Beat and joins us for the Daily Reality Check.
Tonight at 5, it's Bite Marks Cafe with Bert Lum and Ryan Ozawa. And Bert, on legislature's opening day, we wonder how they're going to deal with tech issues this year.
Yeah, you got it, Chris. You know, every session is something new, and we've been tracking some things from last year, and we wanted to see how they would be, I guess, perhaps addressed in the minds of some of our legislators. Particularly broadband is top of mind. You know, there was the idea of doing a fiber landing, and we wanted to find out what's the status of all of that. And then we also will be talking to Robbie Melton from HTDC, and we're interested in her vision of 80-80, which is 80,000 new jobs, new tech jobs, at $80,000 a year by the year 2030. So that's something that I'm sure she's going to be talking to some of the legislators about. And then we have Senator Glenn Wakai on the show as well. And he's the chair of, was it Economic Development, Environment, and Technology. So
something like that, yeah.
Yeah, everything that has to do with what we're interested in kind of runs through his committee.
Well, when you say broadband will be taken up, how does the legislature, what's on your wish list for that?
Well, you know, last session they had this omnibus bill, and right now I think the question is, where does that actually reside? Whose department does that really get its leadership from? And DBED looks like it's going to be the point person for that. And if they are, what are they asking for to manage that process? And I saw something in the budget for like a broadband specialist. So, you know, we want to find out, like, okay, so what does that broadband specialist do, and where do they get their direction from?
Yeah, no kidding. Well, it sounds as if there's much to be sorted out.
Yeah, so I'll be scoping it out today, and then we'll have them on the radio tonight to ask them some questions.
Fair enough, Bert. Thanks a lot.
Sure thing.
That's Bite Marks Cafe at 5 p.m.
For years now, the issue of food security has moved beyond the question, can Hawaii feed itself, to how much more can Hawaii feed itself? But as this year started, Big Island farmer Richard Ha announced he would close Hamakua Springs Country Farms, citing economic issues. That announcement came on the heels of one from Alexander and Baldwin that HCNS would cease sugar production at the end of the year. The land is still there, though, and what happens next will send a signal about the focus of ag in Hawaii, more food grown for Hawaii consumption, or for export. Scott Enright is a director of the Hawaii Department of Agriculture and chairman of the Board of Agriculture. He joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth.
Are we really at a crossroads with Hawaii Ag?
We certainly are. You know, I would make the case that the state is going through a transition. We came of age agriculturally with plantation crops like sugar and pine. You don't see that in any other state in the country. In many states, and for the last year, I was the president of NASDA, the National Association of State Departments of Agriculture. So I represented all 50 states and visited many of them. And there's a rich history of family farms in most of the states around the country. We don't have that. We had large plantations that took up the majority of the prime ag land. So we're still transitioning. When the plantations started to go out years ago, it was thought that we would just transition naturally to a diversified agricultural economy. It's going to take a generation, I believe, to do that. And we're midway through that process.
We're also seeing, you know, family farmers who are here struggling, the situation with Richard Haugh being one of them. I mean, just, a year and a half or so ago, we were talking about that wonderful hydro plant that he had put in, and now he's closing his doors. Those 600 acres may go to other tenant farmers, or there may be other things that happen with that land. Same thing with the HCNS land that may either go to feedstocks or grazing or other things are being talked about. But in terms of this idea of, are we going to be able to grow more here to actually feed ourselves, how much do you see these changes going in that direction as opposed to, well, there's more land available for growing exports?
No, it's, you know, Richard Haugh's case is an interesting case, and it tells us many things about agriculture in Hawaii. First of all, you know, Richard's an older farmer. The mean age for agriculturalists in a state is 60. So Richard was at a point where he needed to decide if he was going to reinvest into what he would do going down the road, and decided not to. And the other point, and it's the point that will drive agriculture in this state and globally, actually, is price point. The crops that Richard chose to grow, which was tomatoes and bananas, were two that he found a price point where he could compete. And that's really what it's all about. We have the capability in the state, because we have excellent growing conditions, to produce all of our fruits and vegetables. We won't be able to produce grains, but we can do what I would call local fresh. But it's whether you can do it at a price point that makes sense. There's what we call the Richard Haugh axiom, because he's said it enough as he's traveled around the state. If a farmer can make money farming, a farmer will farm. And that's it. It's all about price point. And, you know, we're seeing certain commodities where price point makes sense and farmers get in.
There's also sort of an irony built into that, too, in what you've said, that we've known for a long time that we have these beautiful conditions for growth, and yet it will be the price point that drives that growth or doesn't. And that still may leave a lot of people in Hawaii wondering, why can't we, why shouldn't we be growing more here to feed ourselves? Are we taking food security seriously? Are we?
I would say no. You know, if you were to look at yesterday's Star Advertiser and the issues that everybody's concerned about, you know, from the polling, you don't see food security on there. So, you know, the answer would have to be no. The Ulupono Initiative did research back in 2011 on consumer preferences, and they found that 85% of the people that they polled would like to buy local, but it comes apart at price point. It's up to a certain price, and if we can hit that price point, we can sell what we grow locally, and if we can't, they'll buy elsewhere. And so it is and always has been and will continue to be about price point. And there's certain parts, you know, agriculture is many things. It's not just one thing. And, you know, part of it are animal agriculture, our livestock industry has been in a real transition over the last 20 years. Whereas we were milk self-sufficient 20 years ago with a number of small dairies spread around the state, we got to a point 3 years ago where we had two dairies left, and both of them were in financial difficulties. And but we're transitioning out of that now. That created an opportunity. Capital came from elsewhere, someplace else in the United States, and decided they were going to invest in a dairy. And so they invested $15 million in a state-of-the-art dairy on the Big Island, Big Island Dairy. And they're starting the revitalization of the dairy industry. Ulupono's also looking to put a dairy in on Kauai. If these two dairies are each looking to put in 2,000 cows, if we get over 6,000 milking cows, we move towards milk self-sufficiency in Hawaii. And so it's that opportunity. The price point needs to be right for the capital to come in and invest. And in certain sectors in agriculture, we're starting to see that. There's an operator coming in that's going to put a million hen facility up in Wahiwa, and we'll move towards being egg self-sufficient. And so as the if the opportunity's there, and it's all about economics, we can we model opportunity at the Hawaii Department of Agriculture and work with capital that's looking to invest in agriculture in Hawaii.
Scott Enright, there's also been a long-time discussion that because many generations have grown up with cheap food, that we've gotten so used to that that we don't realize that in many places around the world, that's just not the case, and maybe shouldn't be the case with Americans either. Where do you see us sort of on that sensitivity curve of understanding that maybe we just have to pay a little bit more for food, particularly if you want to have food that's grown locally?
You know, the eat local movement, and it really it's a strong trend, and it's nationwide. You find eat local campaigns in every state now, and it's strong in this state and growing. And it speaks to that polling that was done by Ulupono Initiative back in 2011. There's a growing movement towards a preference for locally grown food. That is also a keen driver in Hawaii's agricultural economy. We're starting to see small farms that are doing a good job of producing local fresh and being competitive and making money. So they're true to the Richard Ha axiom, and they're just finding, you know, the right size and the right crops. And that's something the department also tries to help farmers with, is finding the price points.
So, you know, having just said that, it seems that we may be looking at more boutique farms as opposed to larger family farms.
Without a doubt. You know, the cost of land is also one of the key factors in what's going to happen with Hawaii's agriculture. You know, if our mean age of agriculturalists is 60, and we're looking for that next generation, we're hard-pressed to believe that the new farmers are going to be able to capitalize an operation, including buying, capitalizing the land purchase. So we need to find long-term leases for startup ag, just because the cost of getting into agriculture is so high in Hawaii.
You mentioned milk, good for everybody unless you're lactose intolerant. you know, eggs, certainly another basic. But fruit and vegetables also are in that tier of basics.
It's true. Again, it's all about price point. Probably one of our most successful agriculturalists in the state is a gentleman by the name of Larry Jeffs and his son Jonathan, and they're out on Kunia Plain and they're Molokai. And Larry's an economist by training, but you know, strong long history of family farming in Michigan before he came to Hawaii, and he's found crops that he can grow. Larry grows 1 million pounds a week that's all kept here in the state and eaten. You know, it's those type of models that we look to for a fairly sizable for Hawaii family farm.
Specifically what?
You know, Larry does tomatoes. He does cabbages. He does bananas out in the Kunia Plain. You know, those are the three prime crops, and then he'll grow for orders sometimes.
Which sounds a lot different than perhaps, you know, fields of basil, nice as basil is, don't
right.
mean to diss basil, but the fact that you have to have enough food to be able to feed everyone. We're often told that there's enough food in Hawaii for about 10 days for consumers, and then you're on your own.
Right.
So upping that ante, if it's not going to be something that we're seeing driven through the legislature, food security is really not something we're taking seriously. How are you handling this to be able to see a future where, you know, if we can grow a few percentage points more, we might be a little bit more food secure?
You know, again, you know, part of the mission of the Hawaii Department of Agriculture, other than our regulatory mission, is to promote ag. And it's really about modeling opportunity. So on the startup farmers or smaller family farms, we work with them to give them the tools they need so that they can find that right price point and be competitive.
And how many do you think are going to be coming online in the next year when we sit down and look
really
at that?
You know, it really is. I'm amazed at the growth, the interest in agriculture with the younger generation. You know, if our mean age is 60, I'm talking people between 20 and 40 that want to get into agriculture. And what we're doing, Governor Ige's has a strong message to the ledge for capital for our ag loan program, because nobody's lending for agriculture. So the state, if we really want to support agriculture, and everybody says we do, we need to support that ag loan program so we can capitalize these startups.
Which goes back to the real question, how sincere are we about food security in any way better than we are right now?
You know, I would love to answer that, but I can't. We will watch actions and see how it all
absolutely
progresses.
Not really a question for you, but one for, I think, all of us. Thank you so much for coming in. We'll check back with you.
Thank you, Beth Ann.
Scott Enright is the director of the Hawaii Department of Agriculture, chairman of the Board of Agriculture.
Support for The Conversation comes from the College of Business at Hawaii Pacific University, whose MBA FlexPlus program offers a blend of classroom and online classes to fit the lives of working professionals. hpu.edu/business.
Today's Backyard Quiz, we reminded you that Princeville on Kauai is named in honor of Crown Prince Leopapa a Kamehameha. The occasion was an 1860 visit to the site by the prince and his parents, King Kamehameha IV and Queen Emma. He named another part of the plantation Emmaville, but that name never stuck. This landowner was a classic 19th century European adventurer, diplomat, and entrepreneur who had served as the kingdom's Minister of Foreign Affairs and Secretary of War. He came to Kauai to try his hand at agriculture and made a failed effort to grow coffee before switching to the sugar cane that was more suited to the area's lowland climate. He joined with other Europeans and American planters to become a founding member of the Royal Hawaiian Agricultural Society in 1850 and wrote several papers for the society on his experiences on Kauai. He was described by a contemporary historian as the fastidious, meticulous, and verbose Scots busybody, Dr. Robert Crichton Wiley.
And Dana Anderson from Honolulu knew that and called us with her answer. And that's today's quiz. Now it's now 8:49. And before we go, one more note. If you have a quiz for us, send it in. We really like to get your quizzes. Our address is talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000, host of the annual Literacy Leadership Conference, February 1st through 4th, introducing the Leadership Institute track for school and complex area administrators. Registration closes January 31st.
If jazz were a country, it would probably be a banana republic with a revolution every few decades, nobody quite knowing who's in charge. Past jazz revolutions have taken us to the limits of tonality and beyond, leaving each succeeding generation to figure out just where to take the music. For trumpeter Roy Hargrove, not yet 40, jazz is informed by any number of genres of popular and so-called serious music. He's on Hawaii with his quintet. He's with us this morning. Good morning, Roy.
Hey, man, I passed 40 a while ago.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
I'm 46, man.
You look so young. My mistake. Well, you still think young, right?
Yeah, I guess. I don't know.
When you were even younger than you are, what kind of things got you going into your music and your instrument?
I was influenced by a lot of great players like David Fathead Newman, Larry Willis, John Hicks, and Walter Booker, and Jimmy Cobb, and these were some of my teachers, you know, a lot of my heroes, people that I listened to on record and stuff.
The whole history of jazz is kind of this succession of players who taught other players in one-on-one almost, yeah?
Yeah.
The whole idea of how influence gets passed along. Why the trumpet, Roy?
Well, I mean, it didn't matter what I played, but my father was a brass man. He played the sousaphone. Mm-hmm. And I guess around the time I was born, he had a cornet around the house, and so I just started on that instead.
Well, you know, earlier generations of jazz musicians kind of stayed within the jazz path in their recordings, but you've gone in other directions, haven't you?
Well, I mean, I just believe in music, you know. Mm-hmm. I think that if you're going to be a musician, you should be a complete musician and dive into the entire spectrum of music itself.
Well, you have to kind of be exposed to it as well, Did you kind of listen to records from all over the world, or what?
I just, my father was a collector of music, so I guess when I was born in 1969, there was, what was really popular was mostly like R&B and like funk.
Sure.
You know, so we had, the Barqués, the Temptations, Parliament Funkadelic, George Clinton, and Bootsy and stuff like that in the house. And I guess around the time when I started playing the trumpet, whenever you play an instrument, somebody's going to introduce you to jazz at some point, you know.
Sure.
And you either open the door or close it. I opened it wide.
Yeah, you did. Well, were you attracted to it right away?
Of course. I mean, actually, it was, I don't know, when I was about in the ninth grade, the principal of my high school was a trumpet player, and he... we did a faculty concert, and he was playing. We were rehearsing around midnight, and I was listening to him play, and he played like a lot of arpeggios and mm-hmm. stuff. And I asked him, I'm like, well, how did you learn that? And he told me Clifford Brown.
Oh, yeah.
And I had never heard of Clifford Brown at the time. So the next day he called me out of my class and sat me down and played some Clifford Brown records for me. And that really was a great moment for me, you know. It started like a whole train of me listening to a lot of other players like Freddie Hubbard and Woody Shaw and Donald Byrd and others.
Sure. All trumpet players with not just great notes, but a great sound to their instrument. Yeah,
definitely.
Beautiful, rich-sounding mm-hmm. trumpet players. And Clifford Brown, somebody like Clifford, who was early 50s, sounds just as fresh today. That's quite a gift, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the thing that I liked so much about Clifford was he was able to stretch the timbre of the trumpet beyond just the sound, a trumpet sound. It was almost kind of woodwind-like, mm-hmm. you know, with his technique and whatnot.
I really hear a human voice in the sound of a trumpeter like Clifford.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, the trumpet is very, very much like vocal.
Yeah.
A lot of trumpet players try to sing, too, like Dizzy and Louis Armstrong.
Sure, sure. Yeah. In fact, I really think in the case of those two that you mentioned, their singing really completes their music and kind of offers a window into their trumpet playing almost.
Yeah, brass kind of goes hand in hand with vocal and percussion.
Mm-hmm. Because you've worked with some vocalists in your in your music with the RH Factor band in particular, yeah?
I like singers, man. I listen to a lot of singers, especially like Nat King Cole and Ella Fitzgerald. Sarah Vaughan is probably my favorite.
Sure. She's the greatest. Well, it's all about the phrasing, finding that expression, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Thanks very much for coming in, Roy. Good to meet you.
It's my pleasure.
Roy Hargrove and his quintet will perform through Saturday at the New Blue Note in Hawaii. And you'll find out more about that on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
I was listening to your conversation with Hannah a little earlier about her journey from addiction to someone who now fully engages in life, and just, you know, watching her face. I mean, these are the times I wish we had a camera in here, because she was so animated in the way she described the differences in her life.
And didn't fit any of the stereotypes you might bring to an encounter with somebody who was a recovering meth addict, you know, open and happy countenance and a real understanding of the effects of the drug and the effects of addiction, not just on individuals, but on a person's whole world, how a person can betray everyone around her. She was very candid about that.
And unfortunately, that's what so many families who have had similar experiences will also say. But as she was characterizing the we've talked often about the meth project and the not even once. She gave that some greater meaning than just what we've seen on a screen.
Yeah, taking it to the human cost.
Yeah, really liked hearing from her. That's going to do it from us for today. Coming up, we're going to talk to Kathy Betts, the Executive Director of the Hawaii State Commission on the Status of Women. And we're going to talk with Representative Cynthia Thielen about hemp.
And bringing a silent movie theater to the stage with live accompaniment. We like to hear from you on the show, and you can call our talkback line and leave us your comments. The number is 808-792-8217. You can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post comments on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation. Tweet us at HI Conversation or at BKOZHPR.
And if you missed any part of the show or you just want to hear something again, all of that can be had on the HPR2 archive. You'll find links to more information about guests and topics. Just look under talk shows for The Conversation on HPR2.org.
I'm Chris Vanderkirk.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll see you tomorrow for more of The Conversation.